Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 25th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Transformative Development, presented by Mwenda Ntarangwi, number NTM 2006-02. Let's listen in.
Look at the Bible when they have economic models, where you live with your neighbors and your environment as if they are you. That is holistic. And so to have transformative development means you have to be transformed. And I can bring in the analogy of us being here in Holden. I think talking to a few people here, we enjoy the community here. We enjoy the life that we are sharing here. Now, if this is what we enjoy, can it transform us to live our lives that way? Can we take what is at Holden and make it our everyday experience? That means we've been transformed by our experience here. In the same way, transformative development looks at ways in which people are not only changed in one facet, but they're transformed. Just like when you become a Christian, you are transformed. You're a born-again creature. That you are changed completely and lead a very different life. Therefore, in a biblically based model for development, you are looking at every aspect of the human development. And traditional development, of course, as I've mentioned, has been based on economic parameters, and culture has always been a hindrance. In fact, I mentioned this yesterday in my talk, that for a long time, the IMF, the World Bank, all economists thought that culture was a hindrance. If you can get rid of these bad cultural practices, people will be developed. And we as Christians are guilty of this thing. If we go and change these people's culture, they will accept Christ. And so we have had this like 40, 50 years of anti-cultural crusade. We are always fighting culture because the way people do things is not to our liking, and therefore we want to transform them so that we can give this. But we never look at ourselves and say, it is our culture that makes us think this way. It is our culture that makes us think that this is a model for development. And therefore, culture has always been a hindrance. And also, it's been based on external models. There's a story of an economic program that was set up, I think it was in the 90s. And this consultant was given a job in East Africa and West Africa. And what the person did when they finished their East Africa report, they went with the same model to the West Africa and forgot to delete the names of the countries.
Oh, wow.
So they presented a project, you know, saying this is what is good for Senegal, you know, a French-speaking country. With a majority of the people Muslim, very different from Uganda, which as an English-speaking, Uganda-speaking, mostly Christian, you know, and they just replaced Uganda with Senegal, but forgot to change some of the words that pertain to the project. So one model fits everybody, you know. If it works in Uganda, why can it work in Senegal? Because as we know, development projects are time sensitive. You're given 6 months to go in, create something, measure its impact, and give a report. Because that's the cycle. In fact, I always tell students when they have spent 4 weeks in a community, that is the longest any of the economic development consultants would spend in a local area. In fact, they hardly spend time in the target community cultures because they are unlivable. You know, when you are a consultant, you're living a high life, you don't want to go into some mud hut where there's no water, where you don't speak the language, there's always the threat of malaria, there's no life that you can relate to. So why would you spend time there? And yet, do you want to prescribe a certain kind of development model for the people? You know nothing about them. And most of them also are implemented by the government. And we know that the government has its own ideas. It comes from the top and says, this is what we've decided. We are going to follow it. If you don't, we can mobilize our forces and we will change things for you. And it's no wonder that most of them have been very unsuccessful. And this is the reality that we face today. We've moved from measuring people's economic development as prosperity to now asking, are the people well? Are they well? It's almost like, it's almost like the song, "It is well with my soul." Because if it is well with you inside, it will project on the outside. So the new approach is that the culture is the engine that drives development. And success is based on local worldviews and knowledge systems. We cannot assume that the people we want to help do not have anything that they can lend to our new project. We cannot assume that they have survived this thousands of years without any knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know? We cannot assume that they cannot have problem-solving skills within their own cultures. And it is a humbling experience to realize that other people have solutions. You know, we all tend to have solutions, but we think our solutions are the best. What these people need is X, Y, Z. And we hardly ask ourselves, why do we think they need that? What has not worked in their system? And so now it is becoming much more clear that for us to become agents of change, we have to be part of the culture. We have to understand it. I talked about understanding a culture from the inside, and then seeing our own from the outside. Then we can see, what is it that we can lend them, and what can we learn from them? And bring in the principles of Christ here, because the greatest commandment, love your God with all your heart, is followed quickly by love your neighbor as yourself. You cannot love somebody you don't know. You have to It is amazing to see how quickly we can break barriers if we know somebody. Have you talked about people and you don't know them? It's very easy to say, oh, they're that, they're this, they're that. And the minute you know somebody from that group, you always think, what would James think of me making this broad statement? The minute you know someone in that culture, it changes your orientation to that group. And this is why I think in living transformed lives, us as Christians have to know our brothers and sisters in other places first, before we can tell them, we can give you this or you can give us this. And the minute we know that, which means we have to reflect upon what we know ourselves, why we know it, and then what we know of them, so that together we can build something, is a big challenge. But we have many flaws in the past, and I don't know if you've heard of this saying that, especially in Africa, Christianity is a mile wide and an inch deep. It is a mile wide. This covers a lot of ground, but it's very superficial, and many are coming to terms with this because. A shocking statistic from one of my colleagues who is a sociologist in another Christian school did her research and found out that 35% of born-again Christian youth in Kenya have had multiple sexual relations in church. 35% born-again have had multiple sexual relations. And she was doing this because of the AIDS epidemic. And 20% of those have had more than one partner. Okay? And they feel in the survey that they've been born again. In this case, we can say that their lives have not been transformed to lead a life that is desired in the church doctrine that they attend. And so, in this, yes, we can say, yeah, if they've received the word, they have it, but he has not transformed them. And we can see, at least in my own thinking, why this is so. And we don't want to sort of evoke the ghosts of our past ancestors in mission work, but many of them approached church and the people in different cultures as if they had no belief systems that could be appropriated for Christianity. They were approached, the idea that we are going to change them because their culture is heathen, their culture is bad, came in with this idea that we know everything and those people need to be changed. And what we need to do is take away their culture and insert Christianity and all will be well. And what happened is that people took the aspects of Christianity that were compatible with their own belief systems. You know, because a philosopher, a Kenyan philosopher, John S. Mbiti, has in his very classic book say that Africans are notoriously religious. That in everything they attribute religion. You know, when you're walking, you're talking about God. When you're waking up, so the aspect of religiosity was there. But many of the first initial missionaries assumed that that was not compatible with Christianity. The aspect of, reverence to God. And then, of course, came in another misnomer that the Africans worship animals and, rocks and trees. And the actual fact is that God was a present creator in many, many African traditions. But God could only be reached through intermediaries. And since everything is spiritual, the rocks become an intermediary through which to reach God, because you cannot talk to God directly. You can go, God is represented, God is visible everywhere through his creation, through rivers, through trees, through mountains, through rocks, sometimes animals that became sacred. And this meant that they could not talk to God directly, but could talk to God through these structures. Or they could go and use that as an intermediary to reach God. And of course, when you see that, remember, you don't know much about the culture. You think, oh, they are praying the stone, they are worshiping the rocks, they are worshiping the river, they are worshiping the trees and the mountains. But the concept of God was there, the one God created for many, many groups, African groups. And yet, that was not taken in. It was called, and then there was this other ancestor worship. And one of the challenges of us understanding that is because in the cycle of life that is much attributed to African traditional religion is that people have a cycle. You get born, and there are all stages you go through, and then you die and join the living dead, who are supposed to be watching over you. And these living dead are the people who departed. And so they are supposed to also be part of the everyday running of the life in the community. And they are the ancestors. So whenever you do anything, you have to pay respect to them because they are part of this cycle. And that you call upon ancestors and you worship God. And that distinction has never been made by many, that when you call people, you say that the spirits of so-and-so, we ask that you will, because you're using, again, the spirits of the people who have lived to rich guy because age is what graduated you to a higher level of spirituality. The older you are, the more likely you would be called upon to pray for the rest of the community. So that if we have older people in a situation, in a context like this, a younger person would not pray for the community. The oldest would do the prayer, and then you go down to that. So age was something that's very, very valued, and therefore you evoke the ancestors to help you reach God. But that has been very much misinterpreted and therefore rejected. In fact, I remember in my own culture, when the first Methodist missionaries came to our community, they wanted to translate the Bible. And in our culture, we don't have a concept of the devil. But we are the spirits of the ancestors, which were good spirits. And so that, because of the Christian view then, that we had a heathen lifestyle, we were praying to these heathen ancestors, those, the word for our ancestors became the word for the devil. You know? So it's such a dilemma. When you've grown up and you know when your grandparent ages and dies, joins the living dead and is watching over you to make sure that you're protected, now transforms and becomes a devil. You know? And then we didn't have the concept of the Holy Spirit. And so the closest they could get of a Holy Spirit was a shadow. You know, so a tree has a shadow, a house has a shadow, a dog has a shadow, we all have shadows. So how do you tell somebody about this Holy Spirit that is a shadow, that only comes in when there's light? You know, so again, this cultural encounter where the way you perceive what the people were translated into how you brought the gospel. Instead of using the positive aspects of it and say, you know, it is like this. This is how Christianity is. And one of the things that Christianity did for all the religions, including the Jewish religion, was to expand their horizon. Because all these other religions are very provincial. They wanted their God to help them fight their enemies. I mean, you read the Old Testament, it's very provincial. You know, it's like, okay, God, I want you to help me kill my enemies. Then Christ comes in and says, love your enemy. And expands the horizon so that all the little religions had their provincial demarcations are blown out of proportion. And so, okay, this is going to expand your world. It is going to share, to tell you how to share your world with other people who are also God's creation. And that, I think, was the benefit that could have been used in all these other religious practices. And so, you know what? Yes, we understand that you pray, but this religion is the one that goes beyond the physical boundaries that you can see and expands your horizon. Now, when besides that also, there's always a tendency, and I don't know, this is my personal view, but the church is always the nicest structure in the community. I don't mind having a wonderful structure for God, but if people want to be God's creation, and they only see the only structure that is good, that is livable, that is can be shown is the church. We are sending a specific message, you know, that, well, we'll have everything here materially for the church, but we cannot do the same. And therefore, there's always this struggle between accepting Christ and living your everyday life. And also, most missionaries, now there's a big turnaround, of course, because there are many more people trained locally to do mission work. But most of the times, the missionaries had the best of a lifestyle, you know? In fact, that is what drew people to Christ. The material goods of missionaries is what drew people to Christ. And as as recent as 70s, 80s, people would be born again multiple times because they would get the material goods that come with being converted. So you'll see the same people over at every crusade. You see them and they're raising their hands and they receive whatever they're receiving and they go back and then come to the next one because they want private t-shirts or, you know, and they come back. And so it was, they were drawn by the material that was there. And so how do we change that? You know, the rejection of the local knowledge and worldview that they have lived a life that is worth learning about, picking some of them. Now, of course, in hindsight, we've come a long way. When many of our grandparents were being converted to Christianity, biomedical programs were the main thing for disease. Yet, in most communities, up to today, a lot of people don't have access to modern hospitals. They are sustained by local medicine men. And that is always, there's still a struggle. There's still a struggle between that. Because in the traditional sense, even though the medicine man is giving actual physical portions, there is also a lot of psychological healing going on, because then they are connected to various causations of disease, what causes disease and all that. And that has become very hard for people who are trained in the biomedical sphere. Although now we know that the tablet, the capsule, the pill itself alone is not as effective if it is added to something about spirituality, about the wholeness of the person. So aspects that were very crucial, like taking disease to be a breaking of a relationship that injures your body, has become very much part of what we think of biomedics now. Again, the new approach, what can we do? We have to start with what we would consider in the social sciences, a situation analysis. And that means you go into the community. If God has called you to go to a place, the first thing you do is you go and learn about that place. Even if it is just another neighborhood in your community, go and find out. Make friends with the local people. Ask them what their problems are. It is amazing. It is amazing how many people who want to bring change to a community never ask the local people what their problems are. It is amazing. Because they assume, the people coming outside, we coming from outside, we assume we know what their problems are. But the reality is, if they are the ones to change their situation, if they're going to live a life that is transformed, they ought to identify their problems. You know? It is like coming in and telling your child, well, I know what your problem is. I'll give you this and this and this, and then I'll leave you to take it. And then go. Who will ascertain that they take it? Why will they take it? Why should they take it? Do they identify that as their problem? And that has been a big challenge for many, many, many people. Even us, in our own family situations, we always think we know what the problems are with our children. Yeah. I know what is your problem. You know, let me tell you what to do. You know, and it's hard. So we have to do what we call the social situation analysis. What is it like? What are some of the issues? And that is the hardest part, because we live in a culture that should have immediate solutions quickly, and we're out of it. You know, we call it the microwave culture. You can't wait. You know, you go in there, identify the problem, fix it, and you leave. But nothing happens like that. And I always give the example of Christ. What did it take for Christ to change the lives of these people? He had to be born there.